Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Everybody, how you doing this evening? Hope everybody's having a good time. Chris Jordan here, coming at you from Austin, Texas. Sorry about the little technical glitch there, folks. Busy juggling buttons, content, all kinds of things. Man, get ready for an epic episode tonight. In our first segment, we will be welcoming back Tobe Johnson and Brett Eichenberg. They are the creators of Flash of Beauty, a paranormal Bigfoot. And folks, if you have not seen Flash of Beauty, Bigfoot Revealed, that is hands down. Anytime that I hear somebody be like, hey, you know, I don't know, I haven't seen a good Bigfoot documentary yet. There isn't a whole lot of new evidence. I fully beg to differ. Feel free to go check out Flash of Beauty, Bigfoot Revealed. These two gentlemen put that out a couple years ago now. It was right as we rebranded, actually. And it hit like wildfire in the communities. It is awesome. They have Flash of Beauty, Paranormal Bigfoot, going into the woo, folks. That is where we are going tonight. And I love seeing both of these guys on social media. Whenever people are like, oh, that's woo, it's like, just wait till the movie comes out, man, because it's all tied together. It is absolutely all tied together. In our second part tonight, after commercial break, we will be talking with Karen Wilkinson. We did a pre-record here with her today here in the studio. She is the author of Stolen Seed, Evil Harvest, and we will be talking about the alien seeding program, the idea of people being taken, organic material being taken from them, experiments being put on them, and even the points of impregnation and removal of fetuses and fetal tissue from pregnant women, including Karen herself. So an incredibly moving story, and something that really, really causes long, long pause to think about, because there are numerous people that this has happened to. We talked about this pretty regularly with Nathaniel Gillis, our demonologist friend, the idea of missing fetus syndrome, things like that. So we get into whether or not these are tied together, all that kind of good stuff. Before we bring the guys on, let's take a look real quick at the official trailer for Flash of Beauty, Paranormal Bigfoot.
There's things that I won't tell you, that I can't tell you. All I can tell you right now is, and I'll lick you right in the eye, I'll tell you, whatever goes on in these woods, don't take it for what you can see. Because there's a lot more to what you can't see. Bigfoot shape-shifted, folks.
It's not just that Sasquatch exists, it's that Sasquatch can do this and this and this.
We had the hair tested by a vet. It came back as an unknown hair type. Then I turned to Daryl and I said, listen, it could get really weird now.
It was able to do things that you couldn't even imagine.
What are the chances of us seeing something like that? 1 billion to 1? 2 billion to 1? Why us?
I think if you can base some of this in science, it allows us to have the grasp of what's going on. Coherent matter can work in ways that ordinary matter can't, because it's based on quantum principles. So it can easily go into cloaked mode.
and words repeated, why are you carrying a gun? And the second time it went through my head, I knew they're talking to me.
It's not about the one encounter. It's about the thousands of encounters, exact same type of characteristics that tell the story. You cannot deny it. And that's why you have to acknowledge the paranormal aspect.
What did I just see here? Oh my goodness.
And there you have it, folks. Welcome to the program. Welcome back, Brett and Tobe. How are you guys doing?
Fantastic. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Chris.
I have chills right now just watching that and thinking of the possibilities. Just having Google stalked you guys since the release of the last film and just followed y'all closely, and especially followed the work that you've done with Al Moon Lab, things like that, Tobe. Man, you guys have a voluminous amount of evidence and material. It is staggering and astounding is the only way to put it.
Thank you so much.
Let's start off at the beginning. What was it that made the two of you guys want to venture forth and produce your own documentary on Bigfoot to begin with, Flash of Beauty, before we get into what led to Flash of Beauty Paranormal Bigfoot? So
I'll try and keep this quick. I'll try and keep this quick, Chris. Basically, you know, Jill and I growing up, and Jill's the producer on the film, and her and I are married, and we've both had a fascination with the paranormal since the beginning of time, I guess. Maybe it goes back to a past life. I don't know, but there was never a time that we can remember when we weren't interested in mysteries and paranormal and living in the trees, if you will. Bigfoot was a huge kind of focal point of that. And I know the same is kind of true with Tobe as well. And, you know, that lore is part of our culture out here. And so, you know, being that we were filmmakers, it was always in the back of our mind to do a Bigfoot documentary that we thought was kind of sort of missing from the genre, if you will. And after doing some narrative films, some fictional films, the pandemic hit and we realized that maybe now is our opportunity to get out into the trees and do some social distancing, if you will. And, you know, we figured that we would spend 6 months or so putting together a Bigfoot documentary. And that quickly grew larger and bigger than we ever could have imagined. And through that process of making A Flash of Beauty, we wanted to put everything into one documentary, and we realized really quickly that we were not going to be able to fit both the flesh and blood aspect and the paranormal aspect into one film. And so about a month or so into production, we realized that we had to split the two movies into two different chapters.
Wow. And you know, with that being said, as I was saying in our pre-conversation, and as I've said on the show numerous times, I am of both camps. I fully believe that there is a large hominid ape in North America and in other parts of the world. But I also believe that there is something else that is basically using the tropes in our mind that we would be comfortable with. Whether or not that is a Bigfoot itself, who knows? I don't know. But a lot of the instances that I talk to experiencers about, be it UFO, UAP experience, abduction experience, Sasquatch, cryptid experience, and paranormal experience, there are similarities with all those that run so, so deep. And for me to even think about trying to separate them is hard. But the fact that y'all decided to do two different movies, one about the the actual factual hard evidence, Alba Vernix, waxy oils, all kinds of things. And one about the paranormal aspect is awesome. That's awesome. Because there are not only two camps, but two totally different worlds of experience when it comes to these.
Yeah. Yeah. And what was interesting was we were finding, you know, doing interviews with folks that we thought we'd go into an interview and just, you know, talk to somebody about their flesh and blood sighting, if you will. And, you know, we'd have this great interview that would last half hour, hour, whatever. And we'd turn the cameras off and we'd be packing up and, you know, the individual would say something like, and there were also orbs, you know, like, whoa, wait a minute, you know, like,
yeah.
And we started figuring out pretty quickly that anyone that has had multiple experiences with Bigfoot, and I think this is a large percentage of folks that are having ongoing experiences, Tobe, Daryl are great examples, who have started having the paranormal happen. You know, and I think that, you know, in our film, not to give away too much, Tobe and Daryl, they find these amazing knee impressions. You guys aren't going to believe, literally, when you see the video. And had they not found those knee impressions, they may not have become entangled with the paranormal as quickly as they did. But they chose to bring those knee impressions back to where Daryl lives, you know, to a shed outside of his house, his residence. And the paranormal kicked off. It's like Tobe says in the film, the gates of Valhalla opened. And I can let, you know, I don't want to step on Tobe's toes.
No, absolutely not. I mean, Tobe, you have been doing, once again, the work with Owl Moon Lab, things like that, for quite a while. And the things that you have come to discover through that and the experiences that you've had, let's get into some of those real quick.
Okay. You first.
You,
what would you like to know?
the experiences that you have had that led you to the paranormal side of things here.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm playing hard to get here. There's a lot to get through with the Owl Moon Lab. In particular, you know, it's just kind of symptomatic of what Brett was saying in the documentary as a whole, is that it's an example if you engage the phenomena. And we were all too happy to oblige the phenomena because we thought it would be short-lived. And so for us, when it came a-knocking, quite literally, we were all over it. You know, Daryl was recently retired. I was working full-time, but I was able to embrace the phenomena as much as I could and live on site and research on site. And throughout the documentary, you just go, well, now, wait a second. What if these guys did that? What if they did what Daryl and Tobe did? What would happen? And I'm telling you, the stories that we talk about in the Owl Moon Lab really just kind of scratch the surface of weirdness, in particular, the ending of the documentary. But then we, you know, a lot of people don't know that part of the community is also in the Owl Moon Lab story, including a psychic by the name of Tara, who is in this documentary, who I was a little bit on the fence about her story. You know, here we had a town psychic running around saying that she opens and closes portals and sends spirit entities back to their home. And she has guardians that watch after her. And there's, you know, these three gals that are just kind of wandering around the small town saying these things. Well, they end up kind of at the Owl Moon Lab rather quickly when things start amping up beyond just the typical Bigfoot stuff. And they find their way in this documentary, and the stuff that Brett caught on camera while filming this Tara, now right above the Owl Moon Lab, actually we're then rock throwing distance to some high strangeness. We catch on film some really interesting stuff. So, you know, where I was in the beginning with the high strangeness, connected to Bigfoot, is a whole different place than where I am now. So where we're talking is about 2017 to 2023. I think this stuff follows you home. I think it is a psychic spiritual phenomena. And, you know, throughout the documentary kind of ebb and flow as far as how this may work.
That is one of the things that we talk about regularly on this show, guys, is the experience of things following you home. And are you sure you want that? You know, behind me sit tons of books from experiencers all over the place. Very few of them start off like most of them start like a Disney movie, not like a song, you know. there's some sort of tragedy somewhere that either their experience led them to trauma, what have you. And that is probably the biggest caveat that I get from more experiencers is, you know, don't go playing around, you know.
Yeah.
Things can follow you home, and be careful with what you do. More than anything. Now, when you talk following you home, was it the fact that you had not just Sasquatch, but paranormal experiences follow you home?
Absolutely. And when I say follow you home, I don't just mean you. I mean follow family members home that you visit. Certainly anyone within your circle of influence can be affected by the supernatural. And so, you know, for that reason, is this everybody's red pill to swallow? No, but it's certainly mine. You know, it's done nothing but enrich my belief system and affect my worldview in a positive manner. You have to kind of control chasing after this.
Oh, sure.
Habit.
Yeah. No, no, you do. You do.
Yeah. It's so addictive. Once you find out this is real, You can see that in the documentary.
Rapidly.
Oh, it can be totally maddening.
I fully understand people that utterly look over my shoulder at my synthesizers. Like, I understand people that rabbit hole on something that they love and something that they enjoy, you know, and especially if it's the fact of you have the opportunity to do like you guys were doing and live and breathe it. Not go out for a weekend, not go out for, you know, a hard weekend hunt of filming or something like that, but to be out in the thick for that long. Yeah. I could see how you would want to tinker every day with it, and how it may not be a good idea to.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to be extremely careful with this stuff because you don't, being the fact that you can't see it, you don't exactly know what you're dealing with. But we give examples in the film of these beings having empathy, having humanity, having, you know, they care about people, they're gifting, you know, there's a certain sort of curiousness from them too. So there's a reciprocal relationship between the two of us that is a curiosity towards one another. We want to know more about one another. Now, with that being said, I feel like, you know, there is certainly a family unit in these creatures, and then there's going to be a protection of that family unit. And so if you're if you're out tripping and trapping around in the forest doing things you shouldn't be doing, you're probably going to suffer the repercussions. You know, you're going to probably have a frightening time in the woods. And we've certainly heard stories like that, but we've also heard an abundance of stories of people having positive experiences like Tobe talked about. You know, and many of the stories that Tobe and Daryl tell in this film really strike a chord. I mean, they kind of pull at the heartstrings, which to me is revolutionary, because you don't really have those stories from, you know, like alien abductees. You know, most people that are abducted are like, yeah, you know, I had this horrible nightmare, you know, a circumstance where I was like on a metal table and they were, you know, poking and prodding at me. And when I woke up the next morning, I had a scar or something behind my ear or whatever. It was, it was very traumatic. And there's a lot of, in the paranormal Bigfoot world, there's a lot of, what's the word I'm saying? It's more of an intrigue. I think it's more of this like relationship. And again, that has a lot to do with the individual that's having the correspondence with these creatures.
Sure.
You really have to kind of just wear your heart on a sleeve. And if you're in the woods, if you're in an area that's near your home or what have you, wherever you are, you've got to have that respect. You've got to have that positive energy. And we cover that. You know, I think that they can sense that.
Well, just as somebody who was brought up hunting, things like that, your energy going out into the woods and your success or not has such a huge part to do with it. Like if you're, like you said, traipsing around in the woods and stomping and moving around, like, they don't like that. No animal likes that. They're quiet. Why wouldn't you be? You know, is kind of how any deer looks at it. That's why they bolt away from you, because it's a loud, scary sound, you know?
Yep.
And to know that, once again, that there is this humanity behind these contacts, the sharing of things. Now, we're either one, of course, as you said at the beginning, Brett, both of you guys grew up in the Pacific Northwest. You both grew up with this kind of culturally just being there. But were either one of you a believer of paranormal being tied to Bigfoot before you started this to begin with?
I think in the case for myself, yes, I think so, because of the fact that it was always marketed that way as something attached to the stranger side. You know, we had Robert Stack walking out in a raincoat talking about Bigfoot along with ESP and the Loch Ness Monster. But really, Brett and I share something in common, and it's our love for Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind and the character Roy Neary, played by Richard Dreyfuss, who basically is driven by a vision. You know, he's an experiencer. He has this intense experience, but he knows that something is beyond the bend. There is this rabbit hole that he just cannot not go down. And it's that yearning to know what goes around that corner, I think, that drives Brett's filmmaking. If I can speak on his behalf, you get the sense that Brett is just an intensely curious director. And that curiosity is so hard to find in really good cinema.
Yeah,
and you know, I just trusted him and Jill, his wife, so much with their artistic eye that, and so did the likes of Ron Moorhead and Finian Hine and all these great people who are in this doc. Intensely trust these people to tell their story, and that's such a rare thing.
Yeah, and Ron Moorhead is an incredible individual. I've had the opportunity to sit and talk with him and interview him a couple times, and just, he is so genuine with his experiences, and he's had tons of them, and to hear him talk about the tie with paranormal. I was on a panel about the tie with Bigfoot and Dogman and the paranormal, and my whole take was the fact of, especially folks who have had UFO contact, they specifically are very much akin to a magnet or a needle that comes near a magnet. They are put to a different frequency than the rest of us are, and it seems to attract the rest of this, you know? And it's really strange when you start really digging and finding how many people who have had paranormal Bigfoot experiences have also had abduction experiences or experiences with UFO UAP.
Mm-hmm.
There's quite a connection there, and it's really, really interesting to see that. Now, let's get into some of the woo that y'all talk about in this woohoo movie, because I am excited to hear about a lot of this that people have been talking about for years. Things like Bigfoot being able to cloak, Bigfoot stepping into portals. Let's start kind of scraping the trowel across the surface there and talk a little bit about that experience that you guys had out in the field.
Well, you know, we could start off by saying, you know, a lot of the skeptics out there keep bringing up this idea that Bigfoot couldn't possibly be real because we don't have a body.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that the cloaking side of things and the paranormal side of things really kind of helps it's not going to convince a skeptic, of course, yeah. But I think it provides us, you know, us that are looking for these answers with a true explanation as to what could be happening out there. Mm. And the cloaking aspect of it too is something that we really kind of put under the microscope in the film. And Dr. Simeon Hine talks about how scientifically they could be cloaking. You know, we even show a squid that literally it's picked up and it's like transparent, you know, it goes from black to transparency instantly. And so it's not a stretch for us to start thinking about how, you know, biologically speaking, how some of these animals are able to do these certain things that we kind of think that, you know, well, if humans could do that, that would be paranormal. Well, you know, Bigfoot is kind of taking advantage of some laws of nature that we haven't yet discovered. And, you know, it is a little arrogant, I think, for the scientific community to think that we know everything, because we don't. We're making discoveries every single day. Absolutely. And we cover that and we talk about it. We talk and Dr. Hine is talking about some of these cutting edge theories that really kind of help us realize that, yeah, cloaking can be real. And then we have, you know, this video evidence that I have thoroughly, thoroughly analyzed that was shot by Barb Shoup in 2014 with a little iPod Touch in 1280 by 720 up near Mount Rainier. I've scrutinized the heck out of it, and I would love somebody to debunk it because I think it's impossible to debunk. And it clearly shows a cloaked figure of some sort. I can't definitively say it's a Bigfoot. Mm. But what she saw in real life with her own two eyes was a black figure. And it was like it cloaked for the camera, you know, which is very interesting. It's very interesting to me. And cameras, people don't know this already, cameras can see things that human eyes can't. One way to prove that to yourself, you can take the remote control for your TV and you turn on your camera on your phone and point the remote control, and you'll clearly see infrared light blinking. Flashing. It's really kind of a cool experiment. So these things are intelligent enough to realize in the moment that they're being captured by some sort of forever preservation device that would clearly show them, and they somehow intuitively instantly cloak. And that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, the example that I show all the time is this image right here. This is Proctor's Ledge in Salem, Massachusetts. I happen to be nerdy enough to have a full spectrum version of the exact same camera that I use for astrophotography. All it is, most people do not realize that the camera that they buy has an infrared filter in front of it, has a UV filter in front of it, two slim pieces of glass that help filter that out so that glare and things like that are automatically gone. But the one thing I bring up on the show all the time is we visibly and audibly hear and see a minimal slice, like 450 nanometers.
Yeah.
We're deaf and blind. Like it is so small. when you start looking at the way that a parrot sees or a tetrachromic, if you've ever met a tetrachromic individual where they actually can see yellow as well as red, blue and green, like, it's like another million colors that they can see. Mm. It's phenomenal. It's amazing. And there are so many things like that out there where it's like, I refuse to believe that we have even scratched the surface of what that is. You know, even to know that, like, heck, polar bear fur is clear.
Yeah.
So if you just transition that to another species, you know, there's all kinds of possibilities.
Look at a vampire squid. A vampire squid, there's some great images on YouTube that people can look up. And there's different species of vampire squids, but there's a famous video of one that it has these red and yellow and green, like LEDs. It literally looks like a toy. You know, he's kind of just swimming through the ocean, and it's like he's got these LED bioluminescent lights, you know. And then we tell stories, Jill and Michael Ferry, the DP cinematographer, and I, the three of us saw iGlow in the Midwest.
Oh, wow.
And we're like, we tell these stories about how we saw the eye globe. People, oh, no, that can't be possible. And I'm like, well, fireflies are possible. They're generating their own light.
Yeah.
So why couldn't, you know, a Bigfoot, a hominoid that's kind of gone down a different evolutionary path to develop some of these skill sets, have some of these same traits? Because it would make a lot of sense as far as hunting is concerned, so on and so forth. Folks have said that they've seen eyes so bright, they've seen actual eyes shine, eye glow on the forest floor. You know, and Dr. Simeon Hine talks about in the film. So, you know, it's not, some of these things are actually in nature and we're used to them. We're used to seeing fireflies. We're used to seeing glow worms, you know, so it is out there. It's not that far fetched.
Absolutely. I just posted the article the other day about 125 new species of fluorescent mammals that have been found. 125. That's just in the last year of mammals that, you know, fluoresce in their own way. We may not be able to see it, but other animals can, who are sensitive to that light band. And that's just, that is one thing that I regularly say, I think we research wise have a problem with, is that when it comes to Sasquatch, when it comes to alien, we really, really tend to anthropomorphize a lot.
You know, that's right.
And we tend to put a lot of intent behind things. And there is a phenomenon there. That's what's wild. That sadly is what scares some scientists away, is that anthropomorphization, you know, that want to make things so human. And I think is the beautiful thing about using terms like, you know, non-human intelligence, things like that now, because we're pulling it out of the box that scientists were afraid to go into because it was pseudoscience, not actual science, which is, hey, I don't know what's beyond that frontier. Let's go find out, you know, we need a lot more Magellans in science that are just willing to sail to the horizon, man, and see what happens.
Well, there's nothing, in my opinion, there's nothing in the universe that cannot be explained by science. It's just a matter of whether or not you have the tools and or the skill set to do that. Or, you know, if we're intellectually intelligent enough to be able to do that, you know, I mean, and that's why we have scientists. That's why we're working every day to make new discoveries. But the truth is that we still have so, so far to go.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, Tobe, specifically with Owl Moon Lab and the experiments that you've done in Paranormal Bigfoot, let's get into some of the ways that you guys were attempting communication, some of the ways that you guys were kind of poking the Squatch, so to speak.
Well, yeah, I want to go back to the previous comments you both made too, because you know, A Flash of Beauty, Paranormal Bigfoot opens up with a Native American ceremony with T.J. Ravenwalsh, and you know, he mentions this back. He mentioned with us when we were in Vernal, Utah last month as a group, and we were sitting around. Actually, it was during the premiere of the movie there at Phenomicon, and he mentions in his opening remarks ceremonies and before he talks of Sasquatch, he'll say, "Forgive us for speaking so plainly." And I think there is this kind of absence of reverence for what we are talking about here, because there is the science aspect of it. There is the fun of collecting data and having the best tech out there.
Sure.
But there's this forgetfulness of the sacredness of what the hell we're talking about. I mean, this is such a deep layered issue beyond the commercialization of Sasquatch, but it's a hell of a lot of fun too. So I get both dynamics of the whole thing, but you know, when TJ said that, I was like, yeah, there is this forgetfulness on all our shoulders here that we have forgotten that we are speaking so plainly about something so sacred. And I think that's what we're talking about here. This, you know, I call these things a land spirit because they are the perfect marriage of their environment and the physicality of a flesh and blood being, but they are of the spirit too. But so are we. I just happen to think these things live in the spirit a heck of a lot more than we do. And maybe it's because they've embraced the land so thoroughly. But to get to your question, how did we communicate with these things? Trial and error. Sitting back on the tailgate, waiting for the phenomena to approach us because we knew we were in a hotbed of activity. But the quick and short is cameras won't do the trick. Audio equipment seems to be the one piece of tech that they will tolerate and, in fact, enjoy. People can take that for what it is, but I think they actually enjoy the idea of leaving behind some audio signatures.
You know, I was just having a conversation with a field researcher the other day about the concept of, imagine being a creature that's mainly nocturnal and people are just coming out and throwing like infrared floodlights out in your forest, you know, just, oh yeah, I'm going to set up a trail cam with this high powered infrared light on it. like talk about light pollution to the natural animal that lives there.
Right.
Like I'm a backyard astronomer. I go through great efforts to block out stray light. I can't imagine what it's like for them to just see trail cams everywhere and these flashing little lights all over the place.
Well, and plus
I would want to stay away from it as well.
If you go to the First Nations stories about Sasquatch, when they show themselves to a human, it is part of a ceremony themselves of growing up from a juvenile to an older Sasquatch. It's part of their rites of passage to cross in front of a human and not be seen. So this whole idea of catching them on camera goes back to something that we don't even understand culturally, possibly. And it's just no way to actually get closer to the phenomenon. It's a way to push the phenomenon away. Audio seems to be a way to bring it in.
That's exactly what I'm saying, is that if I were a nocturnal animal, I would be going nowhere near the huge array of infrared light or ultraviolet light that you're trying to bathe me with, that more than likely I can see in the range of because I'm a nocturnal animal.
Right.
You know, that is just a logical thing for me. However, The audio, like you said, that is a much more passive and almost toy-like thing whenever you're talking about hanging a microphone from a tree or something like that. I could see how it could be much more interesting to something. Now, you actually sent a clip that I would like to play at this point. Let me cue that up. Here we go. And I'll play that one more time and actually show on screen the heat map, because you kindly have the actual heat map where you can see it. And you can see that one part right there where somebody responds, but the rest of this is absolutely wild. Let's explain a little bit how you came across this clip and what the circumstances were that you caught these whoops in the background, Tobe.
Well, you know, it's an example of just being patient, and perhaps everybody in the documentary has a different level of patience. But with audio, following the steps of Ron Moorhead, who's the godfather of catching Bigfoot language and sounds, you know, I was patient enough. Now, patient means 15 years in the making. I'd never caught audio like that before until I went to this place. And so what do we have there? Well, we have a parabolic dish pointed up towards the Umpqua Wilderness in the little town of Cottage Grove, Oregon, on the backside of a property through an apple orchard. We can't say for certain what's going on there, but I can tell you that most of these experiences, I think we're hearing two different individuals, probably an older one and a younger one, if I had to guess. And these are usually followed up by prints, handprints, footprints, gifts, sighting, strange lights, hitting, banging, hair, those kind of things are preceded by sounds like this. But, you know, it just, it's one of those things that exist. And what are people going to do with evidence like that? I don't really know. Is it going to hold up in the eyes of the court? It doesn't really matter. I'm just telling you that if you want to go have an experience, you can record sounds like this on your own. You don't need just to listen to them. That's much funner to follow in the footsteps like Brett and Jill did and go out and talk to these people. That's the way you really find out this phenomenon is real, is by seeing the quiver in their lip, seeing a tear in their eye develop when they talk about seeing one. It will forever change you, and then you'll have your own story.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. And that is one of the reasons I love going to the events, is being able to sit down, hear people's stories one-on-one, that kind of stuff, hear people's personal experiences. And especially in the cryptid Bigfoot community, there is an acceptance there amongst everybody that I do not see in other crowds, as far as like, hey, yeah, let's get together and go out tonight and go squatching or things like that. Now, the one plus side is that we will soon be able to start leveraging things like AI into the mix when it comes to specifically animal sounds, that kind of stuff. I know that they're working on an AI database of animal calls, things like that, to be able to just rapidly compare and contrast samples for regular wildlife work. And that is something that I highly recommend anybody who is out doing this kind of stuff with trail cams, what have you. Feel free to contact your local university, let them know what you're doing, and guaranteed you there is a biology department that would love to get a hold of your trail cam footage that is utterly useless for you. You know, doing animal counts, things like that. It's awesome, the citizen science that can go on now with all these tools that are readily available to folks. But, sorry about that. We were still open on the computer. Now, when it comes to finding people who have had the paranormal Bigfoot experience, like you were saying earlier, it seemed to be that they told you about their experience, then came to the paranormal afterward, after mm-hmm. interviews were done, things like that. Did you find, as you did this documentary, that more and more people came out as opposed yes. to the first one?
Yes. Yes. And we're still getting that too. So just to backtrack just for half a second,
please,
our new project, that we're working on right now, we're just actually done in Central California filming, is we're adapting Ron Moorhead's Voices in the Wilderness and the Sierra Sands story into a new feature length documentary.
Awesome.
And, I'll just kind of tease it a little bit in that, you know, we're getting some guys to come and talk on camera that have never spoken on camera before. Some of the original Sierra campsite members. And I was surprised to hear them talk a little bit about the paranormal. But we have had some other folks that have kind of, you know, they're starting to feel comfortable. It's, you know, we've been able to build trust. And that's the most important thing, because, you know, this goes back to the ridicule factor that's out there. And we all know, we've all been on social media. We all see that, you know, the trolls and whoever else is out there, that ridicule folks about their experiences.
Yeah.
Which is just simply not cool. You know, and Dr. J. Allen Hynek, I can't remember the exact quote, but he said something to the effect that ridicule is not part of the scientific process. You know, and it's important to listen to people. I mean, you know, there are things that happen in this world that may or may not be Bigfoot, you know, and that's okay. But I think by sharing stories and comparing notes, we're going to start finding a lot of commonalities with folks, yeah. You know, and I think this is the way to really kind of combine the two camps, if you will, the flesh and blood and the woo is yep. we really just need to listen to each other. And, you know, and I don't think it's a bad thing for us to really ask the question, you know, why do you think it's just flesh and blood? Or why do you think that there's a paranormal factor to it? You know, and really hearing each other out, I think, is where we can kind of come together as a community and go out into the rest of the world, you know, confidently say that what is happening is real. Bigfoot is real.
Yep.
And there's something there that really could enlighten humans as to what is on the other side or what is truly out there in this universe.
Yeah. Yeah. And the fact of, as we were saying in our conversation before the show, so all of this is connected. I would love to say it's not. Mm-hmm. The more science comes out, the more science digs, the more we find out about things like quantum entanglement, the fact that two particles can influence each other despite distance, everything else, strange quantities, strange properties of atoms and ions. It's incredible. And we are just learning to tap the surface of that. I would not doubt one bit that there are other things out there that have already done that. And before we let you guys go, because we are coming up on the hour, everything else, we'll start with Brett, then we'll go to Tobe. What was the most remarkable paranormal experience that you had during the filming of this documentary, Paranormal Bigfoot, Brett?
Oh boy. We had a number of them. I think what is probably the most remarkable, and again, you know, you kind of go back after you experience something, you go back and you rewind it over and over again over the ensuing days and months and weeks and whatnot. But, you know, we got some very interesting little tiny orbs that we did. And Tobe was alluding to this. We did this interview with Tara Harris, who's the local psychic, and this was at the Al Moon Lab. And, you know, Mike and I were setting up the shot. We were setting up, you know, lights and cameras and stuff like that. And man, there was just a weird feeling in the air. You know it when you feel it. We've all, you know, those of us that have gone out in the field have felt it at least once or twice. And, it wasn't a dark feeling, but it was a feeling of a presence. And so we're filming this interview and I keep seeing these blips on the screen. And I say to Mike, you know, hey, there was another one of those blips. And at one point I stopped the camera, and this is in the movie. I stopped the camera and I say, hey, write this time code down. And so, you know, I, just like everybody else, I need to really kind of like look at the footage and try and debunk something before I can definitively say that it was real and it was true. And, you know, it wasn't an error of the sensor of the camera. And, you know, I went through the footage, and, you know, when I was editing the movie and I got closer and closer to the footage, and again, I couldn't debunk it. I've been doing video practically all my life, 30 years, at least, no, 35 years. And I've never, ever seen anything like this in my life. And these were, we're talking micro balls. So sometimes what happens in videos, you get these things like dead pixels or flashing pixels.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're square. Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's what these look like initially. And so that's what I was thinking it was, but I was like, this is a great sensor on this camera. It shouldn't be doing that. But what I ended up finding in the editing is I was finding like curlicues, which meant that these little balls of light were moving extremely fast, extremely fast.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, this particular part isn't in the film, because I discovered it after I finished cutting the film, is I found those little flashes of light on a second camera angle, which completely ruled out the fact that it was just that one camera having problems.
Wow.
And then I knew.
Was it at the same time code?
Different time codes. Ooh. So this was like over, because it was a different angle. So it was over in a different area.
Yeah.
So in other words, we were like surrounded by these things. And then we had something else that happened that was really odd at that exact same time that we were having these little blips, and I'll let that stay a secret. But what was really interesting is once we went and interviewed Dr. Simeon Hine, he talked about ball lightning and micro ball lightning, and a scientist in Japan that had discovered this micro ball lightning. And And the ball lightning thing factors into the quantum side of things and everything else. And I'll let you guys watch the film and you can see more about it. But we were actually recording that on camera, and I'm not aware of any other footage that has that. So that was really, really interesting.
Man, I cannot wait to see this thing. It's going to be incredible. Tobe, what was, and I know yours is going to probably be pretty wild because you do quite a bit of work out at Owl Moon Lab, things like that. You have been poking things for a little while now, so I'm sure that you've had more than one experience follow you home. What was your wildest experience while filming this documentary in particular?
Well, as far as things that we caught on camera, with Brett's camera, I would say that moment with the interview with Tara Harris, it's an amazing thing to watch. And there is this other hidden little second part that Brett's not talking about that happens at the exact same time. It's pretty interesting, and it's validation for the area as well. But there is, towards the end of the story, my story at the Owl Moon Lab, because I no longer live down there, there's this COVID moment, this unexpected COVID moment that has to do with humanity, the pandemic, and a search for the cure for COVID that kind of sprung up out of nowhere. And it had to be included because of the fact that it's just so much synchronicity. It'd be foolish to not at least mention it. So we bring it up, and I was rolling camera. Actually, my buddy Daryl was down rolling camera when this moment happened. So we included that iPhone footage along with the documentary. So that's pretty topical.
Wow. And once again, I cannot wait to see this. I have watched Flash of Beauty with at least two handfuls of people that I know of. Doing road work, things like that. We're like, oh, I need to watch that. I'm like, come up to the room tonight. We'll have a viewing.
Cool.
I show it to people all the time, man. The evidence that you guys have gathered just with that is groundbreaking. And I cannot wait to see what y'all release with Paranormal Bigfoot. Congratulations, guys. This is
Thank you, Chris.
Awesome for y'all to be Thank doing you. This. And it comes out on some platforms on the 20th, others upcoming. Where can people find it coming up on the 20th?
Okay, so here's kind of like my little bit of a disclosure here is that right now it's available for pre-order on Amazon and some other platforms, but there's been some things that we're working out with the distributor, and so the film might be delayed a little bit. So if for some reason, you're not seeing it, next week, you're not able to purchase it, we were going to get it out there as soon as possible. And we hate to even delay it one second. We wanted to get it out this summer. So this is killing us. We can't wait for people to see it. We're going to get it taken care of. Follow us on Facebook. If you go to A Flash of Beauty, Bigfoot Revealed on Facebook, we will be making regular announcements, and we'll keep you posted on what it is. And hopefully there's not an issue at all, but that remains to be seen. If you're in the Northwest, come see us in Yakima at the Yakima Bigfoot Conference. And that is, I believe, the 27th and 28th in Yakima. It's at the casino there in Yakima, which is, I'm forgetting the name of it. And we'll be screening the movie there. And we will have some merch for sale and so on and so forth. And we'd love to talk to you guys and hear your stories.
Awesome. Guys, thank you so much for coming on the show, sharing your experiences, sharing the making of this movie. It is, I can't wait to watch it. Like I said, the first one is incredible. I cannot wait to see what y'all have done to bring forth the paranormal with this phenomena. So thank you for all that y'all have done, and thank you for tonight. I appreciate your time, guys.
You're so welcome, Chris. We thank really you. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank I'll be you. Sharing links, all that kind of good stuff. Thanks so much, guys. Greatly appreciate it. I'll let you guys go.
Okay.
Have a good right. night.
Take care. Man, the information that Brett and Tobe put forth in the first Flash of Beauty movie is phenomenal. I'm here to tell you, if you have not seen it, go watch it. It is all on all major platforms. I want to say it's on Freevee now. But man, when you're talking handprints, hand oils, hair oils, all kinds of new forensic techniques. Once again, I cannot wait to see how they have leveraged new technologies to explore the paranormal side of the Bigfoot phenomena. Because as much as I hate to say it, folks, once again, I myself am a believer in the woo. I believe that there is something there. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's if Sasquatch, the physical being, is the same thing that's doing that, or if it's something else that is using the guise of Sasquatch so that we're comfortable, beats me. But there is definitely something to this, and it is awesome to see filmmakers like Brett and Tobe and Jill doing films like this. When we come back from commercial break, everybody, we will be joined by Karen Wilkinson. Karen is an abductee. She is an experiencer. She is also a part of the Alien Seeding Program, a program by which people are abducted and ovum, sperm taken from them, things like that, to even to the point of impregnation and having fetuses taken. We will be getting into that and so much more with Stolen Seed, Evil Harvest, with Karen Wilkinson right here in the studio after this, folks. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that commercial break. Thank you so much to all of our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science right here in Austin, Texas. Christopher Lynch has some of the most amazing product out there. I was prescribed CBD by my doctor for my anxiety years ago for travel supplement. And when I found him, he is the only place I have found anywhere across the country whose product actually has a terpene profile. Go by, check them out. TrueHemScience.com is the website. Curious7 is the code that you want to share to get 7% off of your entire cart and two free edibles on your way out the door. So our guest in this segment is Karen Wilkinson. Sorry. She is the author of Stolen Seed, Evil Harvest. She is also in the documentary series UFO Disclosure, made by our friend and former guest L.A. Marzulli. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me here.
It is great to have you here in studio.
Yes.
But we were preparing for a pre-recording. As we shared information, it was like, well, I'm in Austin. Well, so am I. Why are you by a distance?
So right. Why aren't we doing this in person?
You came into the studio.
Yes.
And in the process of doing pre-records over the last few days, the topic of alien seeding has actually come up a few times. And your experience with Stolen Seed is incredible. Let's start off with when did alien contact begin for you?
From as early as I can remember, my youngest memories are memories of being taken, of trying to find a place at night to hide before I went to bed, or, you know, to try to stay away from them, of being terrified. So from as early as I can remember.
Wow. And now, when you were taken, what did they, especially younger, because I guess you do have ova stored for later in life, but mm-hmm. were they taking seed from you at that point, or was it more a contact modality, I guess, a way for them to get you into a system, so to speak?
I think that's exactly right. It was a way to establish contact, a way to figure out who I was. Was I a good match for what they wanted, for the genetics they were looking for? They did a lot of testing on me, a lot of, you know, blood tests, looking at every part of me. And, you know, so initially it was that. It was introducing me to a person that I talk about in my book, introducing me to a handler who would be with me throughout all of my abduction experiences.
Wow. Wow. So you actively have an individual who you deal with every time that you were taken.
Almost every time. Yeah.
Was this experience from the get-go traumatic for you?
Absolutely.
Did it begin as trauma?
It began very traumatically. And then at some point, you have to find a way to just deal with it and compartmentalize it and...
That's hard.
Go on with life. And for a small child, it's very hard. I had a breakdown when I was about 6 years old, and they found me in a bathroom stall at school. And I write about this, so I won't give away the whole story, but just falling apart. You know, and I think that was my first real public breakdown. Well, so it was very hard.
And, you know, especially now with the conversation being what it is toward disclosure, experiencers coming forward, everything else, Karen, one of the things that we talk about regularly on the show is, are you sure you want this to happen to you? Like, so many, there are people out doing CE5,
right?
Attempting contact, and I'm about 50-50 on that, mainly because, like, I don't know if I would go attend a seance.
Right.
You know, like, there's something different going on when you... between observing a phenomena,
right,
and provoking a phenomena,
right. Why would you want to call forth something that could potentially harm you?
Yeah,
I mean, you know, tell me if you think abducting somebody's 5-year-old child is okay. Where'd you go pick someone's child up off the street and take them? No. If that's potentially going to happen when you call something forward, are you putting your family, yourself in danger? Do you know for sure? Are you willing to take that chance?
Number one, is this still occurring to you?
No.
No. Okay. No. Had you come to a point toward the end of it or anything like that where you had found, I guess, any kind of peace with it? Not necessarily a compartmentalization of your emotion, but an understanding of why it was happening, maybe?
There was a point in time where I bought into what they were feeding me, the information they were giving me. I was basically being programmed to believe a set of facts that they were giving me, which turned out not to be true. But it was sort of a Stockholm syndrome situation where I was attached to the beings that I was seeing most often and comfortable with and believing what they were telling me. And you know, making excuses for the trauma and the things that were happening to me were horrible. And I write about a lot of those things. So they're hard to talk about. They're hard to write about, too. But it was also cathartic in a way to be able to get those things out.
Oh, I'll bet. And that is, once again, the books all around us here, that is what I hear from more and more experiencers, is that it is good for them to talk about it. It's good for them to be able to have the conversation. It's good for them to be able to help other experiencers.
Absolutely. And that's why I did this, because we need to start the conversation. It needs to be okay for someone to come out and talk about this and not be called crazy.
Yeah.
To be believed.
Absolutely.
To be heard and to be helped.
Yep.
That's the most important thing, is people need to know that there's support, that there's help, and it's okay, that there should be a way for it to be okay for people to talk about this and not be treated poorly.
Yeah, no, exactly. And especially when you're talking about the experiences that you have had, where, and we'll get into some of that in detail in a minute, if you don't mind. I know it can be very personal and it can be very hard. So if any point you don't want to share, please do not hesitate to let me know that.
It
can be very, very hard, especially whenever you're talking about childhood trauma that goes back that far. Even our guest Sev Talk that we have on regularly, she had contact early in her life, but it wasn't until later in life that she came back with marks on her, that they'd apparently done experiments, things like that. And it took her a long time to come out of that victim mentality.
Yes.
She was already living in one in her life. and kind of viewed things through that filter, which many victims do, fully and understandably.
Absolutely.
And it can be extraordinarily hard. What was it like for you to, I mean, did you come forward to family first?
No, not
about
at all.
This?
Not at all. No. It's not something you want to come forward to anyone with because you're just not comfortable with it. And everyone, you're told, I was told from a very young age not to talk to anyone or that bad things would happen to my family, my friends, my loved ones. And I'm very specifically shown screen memories of what could happen. Very realistic, horrifying things that could happen to my loved ones. So I was quiet. And then there's just this stigma that goes with, you know, when you're what do you do? I tried to tell my best friend this and she just laughed and thought I was joking. And I'm like, okay, yeah, you know, end of that conversation. So you just, it's very difficult to talk about. There's a lot of trauma. And I was able to deal with that through, I had a near death experience. I call it a near life experience because, you know, I lived through that and it was amazing.
Yeah.
But after that, I had done some PTSD therapy. And because of that, I was able to deal not only with the PTSD I experienced from having that, but with the PTSD from a life of being abducted. So that's when I was able to finally hook up with L.A. Marzulli, tell him what had happened to me, and then eventually write this book.
Well, and for you to be able to get to a point of writing the book to begin with is incredible, because this is a harrowing experience to have gone through. I know numerous people that have been chipped, implanted, been part of experiments. And that's just it. Like, I have a lot of conversations with researchers, things like that. And I have, especially after reading the books, talking with experiencers, I have a hard time believing that every species out there has our best interest at heart. I don't think that they would be putting people through these traumatic... If you've got that kind of technology, everything else, guaranteed you could keep that person from having a traumatic experience.
Absolutely.
Like,
right. Why do you need to abduct people? Why do you need to take things from them? Why do you need to take sperm and ovum? Why do you need to take a fetus? Why do you need to do these things? Well,
that's
the big
one. People
do not...
People do not realize that there are cases of not only impregnation mysteriously and even virginally, but those fetuses just vanishing.
Yes, they do. And I write about that in here because that's happened to me. And then the government admits it. I have included in here the report that says unexplained pregnancies.
Yeah.
You know, and that for me was a big day because it's like, oh, they're finally admitting this is happening to other people.
Yeah. Now, what was the first experience beyond just being taken that you remember? What do you remember happening?
When I was little, I remember going up through the ceiling or through a window. And that feeling of dread when they are first coming, you just feel them coming and you know they're coming and you're terrified and you have incontinence issues or you have... You cover yourself with the covers and you close your eyes and you just, you know, anything you think you can hide, it you can't. And they show up, you feel them coming, this just feeling of dread comes over you. And then they'll either put you into a state of sleep, but sometimes not right away. And you just feel your body start to kind of vibrate. And then it feels almost like your body starts to split into a thousand million little pieces, almost like little ball bearings. Ooh. And you go through a window or a ceiling and you see every detail above you on a ceiling, every detail of the, like our ceiling, the ceiling I went through most often had wallpaper. And I remember all the little seams where they were curling at the edges and things like that, because I'm right there. You know, those aren't things a five-year-old can see from the floor. You know, and just, those are the earliest memories. And then of seeing, you know, the houses and seeing trees and seeing the, you know, river or whatever else happened to be around me at the time.
And At that point, mm-hmm. what kind of experimentation were they doing on you? Were they already taking ovum from you?
Not that I know of, and I am not sure because they didn't sit down and say, okay, we're, you know, like at a doctor's office, this, we're going to do this and this and this. They just went at it. Most of the time I'd be asleep. Sometimes I'd wake up in the middle of it and they'd be inserting a needle into, you know, my neck or, you know, taking blood or doing things I couldn't understand what they were. Some things like seemed like x-rays and things like that. They're always examining me and keeping tabs on me and watching me. And then there were some times when I would just be in there sitting at a little table with other children. You know, some children looked normal. Some looked very not normal. So I'm assuming some were human. Some probably weren't.
Okay.
Maybe hybrid entities. And there were different kinds of entities around. You know, the typical grays were the ones that come to get you, and I write a lot about what they are. And then there were other types as well.
What was your experience with them, with the grays in particular? The
grays are very robotic. They're very methodical. I really do believe that that is a type of avatar or meat suit. Many abductees will talk about, or experiencers will talk about seeing the empty suits on the ships. And I believe those suits are utilized for either an AI-type being to operate or a demonic entity to go into because they need a corporeal being and able to do things. But those gray aliens are very limited in what they can do. Their mouths don't open. They don't have... You know, they don't have sexual organs or anything like that. They're very frail. Like, they look like you could just snap them in two. You know, they're so little. So they're clearly made for a very specific purpose. And they don't smell good. They don't look good. You know, they're terrifying. I mean, the eyes are just black and vacuous. You don't see any life in there. And they're just scary, just terrifying. I mean, I can't look at pictures of them.
Now, was your, I guess... emissary, the person that you dealt with, typically were they a gray or were they another?
No, he appeared to me as a human. That was the image that he put forth that I would see, so that I was comfortable. He looked like a very square jawed, very well built, almost military type person. Most of the time.
And most of the time. And that's what I was about to ask. Did he ever change form? Did that ever change for you? Like throughout your life?
Yeah, he did. And as I was more comfortable with him and felt an affection towards him in sort of a Stockholm syndrome again, sort of way.
An identification.
Yes.
So to speak.
I identified with him. He was the person in quotes that I was with. And I got more comfortable with him. He would shift his form into his natural form and say, I don't want to scare you, but this is who I am. And I said, I'm okay with that.
Sure.
I want to, you know, and it was mostly telepathic communication. We didn't speak as much as telepathically.
The main reason I ask is because one of the things we discuss on the show regularly, we'll be discussing it. We just discussed it. Let me say, because this is pre-record for tonight, and we're having Brett Eichenberger on talking about Bigfoot, things like that, paranormal. Cool. And one of the things that I have tried to explain to people is I fully believe that there is a hominid species across the globe, what have you. But I also believe that there is something else. And when I say something else, I don't know if it's an entity. I don't know what it is, but it is using the tropes that we are comfortable with.
Okay.
To identify with us. Mm-hmm. And so many times it's the case with abductees where these beings take a form that they are familiar with and comfortable with.
Absolutely, yes.
And,
that's it.
And that is, and that's what kind of creates the quote consent for the experience, you know, because I mean, especially if you're looking at this in any dark entity kind of way, things like that, the only way that they could be granted that access is through consent. The vampire right. can't come in if you don't open the window.
Right, but someone else can open the window for them, too.
Absolutely.
And I do believe that someone else was giving them consent, because as a small child, I did consent to that. But I know what you're saying. Absolutely,
But the fact of having a familiar... something familiar there that you could identify with.
Yes, yes.
Continues sure. that process.
And I think that's where there's a handler. For those of us who are being helpful, I think I was a good genetic match for what they wanted to do. Well, my blood type was right. My body was very fertile, and they were able to fertilize these entities using my womb and my eggs. And so they wanted to keep tabs on me, and they wanted to have someone there that was watching me and that was keeping, you know, close to me and keeping me in the program, as it were. Mm. And, they try to make you comfortable so that you are, participating with less resistance.
Absolutely.
So.
Absolutely. And, but I would imagine if you weren't under, there would be a little resistance, even if you saw a knife coming to you for a surgery you knew you were going into.
Absolutely. Yes, there would be a lot of resistance. And there's still most of the time, I do not remember most of my abductions. You know, I remember maybe the beginnings and the ends of a lot of them, little bits and pieces here and there, the middles. Yeah. But for the most part, you're out. You know, they've put you under. They've put you into a state of... similar to having where you are when you're in surgery. I've had a lot of surgeries and you don't have anything from the time they put you under to the time they bring you back out. That's just a blank. And that's very similar to what they do.
Now, when was the first time that you remember any kind of reproductive experimentation going on?
There was a time when I was pregnant, my first time that I actually had I was married, so it wasn't a surprise that I got pregnant. Okay. Went to the doctor, you know, had pregnancy tests, got my prenatal vitamin prescription, because back then couldn't just get them over the shelf. And I was excited. And then I started to feel bad at about 10 or 12 weeks. And, but I was just spotting. I didn't have anything that would be like a full-on miscarriage. Mm. But just hurt so bad. So I went into the hospital. And they did an ultrasound. There was no heartbeat, no fetus. So they did a DNC, and there was no fetal tissue. And the doctor even came out and said, "Are you sure you were pregnant?" You know, and for a new mother to be, that was devastating.
Devastating to begin with, much less to be asked, are you sure you were pregnant?
You know, I had so many plans. I was so excited, and I never got to mourn that baby. You know, I never got to bury that baby or have a memorial or anything, because it wasn't there. But you know, so that happened, you know, more than once. And, I don't remember being impregnated, you know, and I don't remember them taking it out. Obviously, they knocked me out for those procedures. But it was very real once the baby was gone.
So you have more than... because you do have children.
I do.
You do have children. Thank God for that.
Oh, yes. And I am blessed.
Because it can be very hard, especially after miscarriage.
Yeah.
So...
it was scary to...
To do absolutely. That. And even to go through... numerous cases of this. How many times do you know of that you were pregnant and experienced missing fetus?
At least three that I can confirm. That I can confirm.
Wow.
And then I just kind of stopped taking pregnancy tests after a while, because it was too hard.
Yeah.
And I'm like, if this is just going to keep happening and I don't understand what's happening, and I was really in a state of denial about it, then it's like I knew, but I didn't want to, I just didn't want to let my mind go there. It was too hard. So I just started ignoring it. It was really hard.
And how long before you, I guess, came to terms with it? And
I don't think I've ever come to terms with it. I don't think I'll ever be able to come to terms with that.
Yeah.
It's just too tragic.
Yeah.
It was just too hard. And to this day, it's still hard. I mean, I'll go to an L.A. Merzulli will do some of his presentations, and he'll talk about that. And I always have to leave the room because I start crying.
I can even hear it in your voice right now, just sitting here with you. And I've had numerous miscarriages, family, friends, things like that. Not myself, but in family. And it is nothing that is light or easy to deal with. And it is something that, yes, you never get over. And I cannot imagine what it would be like were it the case like yours. When was the last time that you remember that happening to you, Karen?
The last one would have been about... I have to do the math.
It's okay. Take a moment.
It would have been about 25 years ago, maybe the last one.
Wow.
Yeah, 20, 25 years, probably. And obviously, I'm a little older now, so,
But at the same token, what was it like for you when the experiences stopped? Was there a moment of confusion in your life as to why they stopped?
Well, I mean, as far as the pregnancies or the abductions, the abduction experiences didn't stop until a few years ago when I rededicated my life to the Lord and I... You know, I found my path back. And then I was able to take away the permission that they had to take me. So that gave me the opportunity to stop.
It's okay.
So that now they'll still try. And they have definitely tried.
Interesting.
Often.
Yeah.
And every time they try, I can just stop it like that.
Wow.
So.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's just, you know, thank God. Thank God.
So you are aware when they are trying.
Oh, yes.
To
very
abduct
much so.
You. And those situations still occur.
Mm-hmm. They do.
And,
and they still pop around. They're more outside the window. They can't come into my home anymore, but I've seen them out there. And then there are those, you know, just it's scary. You know, it's still scary. I still get the sleep paralysis from time to time. Mm. I still have they're coming at me trying to, you know, get back to me. They really want me back in that program for some reason. As an ambassador to it, I don't know, but I think they don't like what I'm doing now. Obviously, that's definitely going against their program because I'm helping people to stop abductions.
No,
that's definitely not what they want.
At any point, did you come to any understanding as to why this was happening to you? Why this program was even happening?
Well, I can only speculate
because
they've never really sat down and said, so, you know, here's why we're doing this. Genetically, I think I was a good fit for them. I think it was a hereditary thing. I think they work within genetic lineage because our lifespans are not as long as theirs. And when they find a genetic line that they like to work with, they want to keep working with that.
Interesting.
There aren't a lot of good matches out there for them.
Yeah.
I think they've had a lot of hit or misses when it comes to trying to create hybrid beings that are a cross between a human and a non-human entity.
Yeah.
So that is, I think, one of the main reasons why they chose me.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you bring up familial lines because numerous is the case when you go back and start looking at things. I mean, even our guest and friend Kathleen Martin has had experiences. She is related to Betty and Barney Hill.
Oh, that makes sense. That makes sense.
There is a familial connection with these experiences, and it's interesting to see that. And
then I think for some of us, too, some of us remember more easily. Some of us, the screen memories and sleep things don't work as well as for others. So it could just be that family lines of certain people aren't as affected by what they do.
Sure.
To block those memories. Or it could be that they're after specific DNA. We just don't know. Anything we say at this point is speculation.
Yeah.
But I think there's probably quite a bit to it that we're just not even aware of right now.
Wow. How many times in your life would you say that you have at least been taken by entities? And were they the same entities every time that they took you?
The little grays are probably never the same twice, you know,
sure,
because I think they're like disposable tissues. They just pull one out whenever they need one. Not to be flippant about it, because it is very serious. Probably hundreds of times. I have no idea. Wow. But the number of nights that I'd feel the sleep paralysis come on, and then, you know, over my lifetime, and I'm, you know, almost 60, so it's getting up there. So it could be hundreds of times easily.
Yeah.
Easily.
Now, one of the things that we do talk about regularly on the show is that idea of wanting this experience. You know, once again, it's strange to me, after reading so many books and talking to so many people whose initial experience, they may, once again, may have come to terms with their experience later. They may have come to understand their experience as something just for them, that changed them in a different way. But how do you feel about people who are searching for the experience of contact?
You know, for me personally, I would not go searching for it. And I would not recommend that anyone do that. I write in the book that this is not a club you want to be in. What they do is not pleasant. It's terrible. It's heart-wrenching to go through some of these things. And it's, you know, the amount of trauma that you go through and the amount of healing that it takes just to be able to talk about it. There are people, I've heard hundreds of people say they can't even look at the cover of like Whitley Strieber's book because that,
yeah,
you know, and even though I don't think that even looks quite close to the ones that I've seen, it's close enough. I can't look at it. You know, it just, the first time I saw it, I just jumped back and like, oh
yeah,
you know, it was a shock and it's triggering. And then triggers all these horrible emotions. So I don't know why anyone would want to do that to themselves and put themselves in a situation where it could possibly harm them or a family member or put their children at risk. I mean,
yeah,
you know, where is it okay? In my book, it was never okay to abduct a child. You know, if you do that in this world, you go to jail.
Yeah.
It's not okay.
Well, and that's kind of the point that I brought up, is that there may be some species out there that does have our best interests at heart. I would not doubt that whatsoever. I would assume the fact,
absolutely,
and I think that we especially mistakenly anthropomorphize aliens a lot and give them a lot of human quality.
Right, they're not human.
Which means that, you know, like we would strive to be one with all. That doesn't necessarily mean it's the case with them.
No, I think that they are beings that were created before us by, you know, I believe in God. I believe in our creator God, our one creator. I believe that there are angelic beings that were created before us, that these beings don't work in the same realm that we do. They don't apply the same laws of physics that we do. They don't have the same restraints that we do.
Sure.
So when we try to make sense of these abduction experiences and we try to make sense of what's going on, we can't, because it doesn't fit into our paradigm. It doesn't fit into the little box that we live in. It's a much broader space out there, and we don't understand it at all.
Yeah.
And we aren't built to be a part of that. They aren't built to be a part of our space. And that's another reason I think they use the grays, because they're not really built to be in our environment, in our space anymore. Mm. That's why I think a lot of this happens underground, underwater. I think that's where the grays are utilized. But, you know, I think there are good angelic beings, and I think there are fallen. And we know those fallen from different books of the Bible and non-canonical books like Enoch and Jasher.
Sure.
There's lots of information out there about that. And those fallen ones, they're not they are not benevolent. They are out here for their own purposes, and that purpose is not to help us.
Well, and that goes straight into the work of people like Nathaniel Gillis, who we have on the show, who talk about a race of basically half man, half spirit,
right,
beings that require flesh to move forward. Like there's a part of them that is eternal and will keep going, but they need flesh to move forward. They need flesh to embody. And that's
right.
That's,
if you're talking about the Nephilim, if you're talking about the Nephilim, the ones that were killed, their spirits are then the demonic spirits that are looking for something to inhabit. And that's where the grays come in. That gives them a thing to inhabit.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, they're working for their predecessors, their fathers. They're the fallen angelic beings. So those demons have their bosses, basically, you know, in the hierarchy. They're not as high up the food chain. So they're going to follow orders. Because I've heard a lot of people say, well, if they're demons, how come they're, you know, not attacking people, the grays? Well, they're kind of constrained in that little gray suit.
Well, it's also the fact of, much like why any demon who possesses you will not take you to the point of death.
Right.
Why a parasite doesn't want to kill the host. Exactly. It may draw all kind of nutrient from it. It may malnourish the host even and do damage to the host, but it will not take it as, it will rarely take it as far as killing the host.
Like a virus.
Unless it's the fact of killing the host means transformation into something else for it.
Exactly. You know. Unless it gives it some sort of benefit.
Like it becomes a catharsis cocoon and now it grows wings and moves on.
Right.
Parasites normally don't want to kill the host that they embody.
Definitely not. They need that. Just like a virus. It needs that body.
So with that in mind, because that brings a whole new realm to the seeding program and the idea of taking sperm, taking egg, taking flesh to create that. That is an incredible revelation.
Right. You're talking about modern day Nephilim.
Yeah.
You're talking about back to the days of Noah. You're talking about opening a huge can of worms when you get into that. You know, that subject, because that is a huge subject to talk about.
Well, and especially, I mean, opening the conversation like they have. I love the fact that you used the term taking it outside of the box. That is what I've been using on the show, is that we define things by boxes. And for some reason, we want to put it all in the same bin and just call it Kleenex.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
And when that happens, it homogenizes things and it homogenizes research and it really puts a myopic view on stuff. Even if you're saying alien research, like, okay, no, all we do is research aliens. Like, now you've put it in the same box that the scientists who said it's not science put it in.
They put it in a little tiny box and you haven't given it anywhere to actually become what it actually is, which we have no idea.
Well, and that's just it. As of right now, we don't know. We don't know. There may be some people that know what some of these objects in our sky are that are more than likely man-made, things like that. You know, may perhaps interdimensional, who knows? Right. But the fact that they are now using non-human intelligence is great. But it also opens up the realm for that. And it also opens up the realm for, especially when you start going back and reading ancient Hebrew texts and older texts and talking about things that live in the abyss.
Things that are chained, things that live in the abyss, things that have happened in the past, angels that fell.
Well, and especially the idea of USOs and things being under our water. And that being the next place where we should be looking.
Underground,
it ties
underwater.
A lot of that together. It really does.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, it does.
Well, especially whenever you look at L.A.'s work, specifically L.A. Marzulli's work into the Nephilim giants in America, things like that. Like, there are numerous stories right here in America about that.
Absolutely. Yeah, so much has been taken or hidden or obfuscated so that people won't know the truth. Why don't they want people to know the truth? You know, it's out there. What is the truth? LA says that all the time. What is the truth? You know, I mean, why won't they share that? The powers that be, you know, I mean, I grew up in central Ohio around the mounds, the ancient earthworks. We played around the Serpent Mound and on the ancient, they called them Hopewell earthworks. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we knew that some of the tribal people around there, and they're like, these aren't ours. We didn't build these. And their names aren't Hopewell either, by the way. That was the name of a farmer. And then the Smithsonian and the British Museum also came in and took all the things that were in the mounds.
Yeah, all the skeletons, took all the bones, everything
took all
else.
The relics, yeah.
And
just all of it, and took it away. And yeah. Some of it was, you know, belonged to these native tribes. They should have that stuff back.
Yeah.
It wasn't right.
Absolutely.
So they're
absolutely
obscuring that.
Well, and, you know, when you're talking about possible links to giants in the past, things like that, and beings that have existed that long and continue to exist, that is fantastical for a lot of people to believe or it fathom is. Even.
It is. Well, most people don't want to get outside their comfort zone, which is their, you go to work, you come home, you go to bed, you get up, you go to work, you come home. But there's so much more. There's so much more out here. And now some people are being forced to reckon with this because now we have government whistleblowers. Now we're getting some forms of confirmation. Yeah. You know, do I ever think we'll get disclosure? Probably not. Because they would have to admit to their involvement.
Yeah.
And from what I have experienced and what I have seen, there were people working there. They weren't all other entities. There were people as well.
Oh, sure.
So, you know, to admit all that, that would be disclosure. Do I think that will happen? I do not ever think that's going to happen.
Yeah, no.
I think we'll continue to get some drips and drabs.
The big de-disclosure that we will see will be a legal disclosure. It will be a disclosure of the fact that there is tons of black money.
Yeah.
That is the disclosure that we will get, is the confirmation of the fact of, yes, there have been reverse engineering programs.
Right. They may freight a ship
that
around
kind of stuff.
Yes,
we have reproduction vehicles. Yes, we have other technologies that have been based on this. And interestingly enough, like, I had a remote viewer, pretty up there status remote viewer, tell me that the Greys specifically, because of what they are and because of the fact that they are basically hive mind, little ants, you know, they have sacrificed individuality. So though they have these amazing realms of technology, they have no new means by which to apply it.
Yeah, I just
so they're using us and our ingenuity to engineer their stuff into usable things for them that help their society. So interesting that even you would be seeing humans and them working together and side by side.
And there are different types of Greys too. I mean, you have the little ones that come to pick people up, but when you're there on a ship
the ones
or
that
in a
scurry
facility
about almost like little ants.
Yeah, they're just, and they're the suits. I mean, they're the suits that you see piled up in the corner or in a drawer or hanging up. But they're older, taller Greys. They look older. They have expressions on their faces. Their eyes move and change. Their eyes will move back and forth. The little Greys don't. They have wrinkled faces. They show what looks like age. They're taller. They're more sturdy. And you can tell that in hierarchy, they're ordering those littler ones around.
Yeah.
So there are different types of them as well, and different races of entities. Just like, you know, there are different types of things in our animal kingdom. They've got different types of beings. And biblically, you can find all different types of angelic beings described. So it makes sense that, you know, we've seen lots of different kinds. I think the Greys that we see are really just a vehicle to get information back and forth, a vehicle to bring people back and forth, a vehicle to be in our environment, in our atmosphere, and in our space, and to get around some of the rules. Because you can't invite a vampire in, but what about a robot?
Yeah.
Can a robot come in?
Yeah.
Doesn't have the same requirements, does it?
No.
So you got
precisely an
AI Grey or something like that? Well, maybe they can just come right in.
Well,
and I believe they can, and they have.
Well, and that is exactly the point that I brought up in numerous circumstances, whether it's seeing Bigfoot disappear into a portal.
Right.
Are you sure that was the physical Bigfoot, or was that something using the trope of Bigfoot that you're comfortable with seeing?
Right, exactly.
And once again, exactly, no different,
right.
using that modality Because you're comfortable with it. You wouldn't right. You wouldn't be shocked like you would if you saw them in their natural state.
Exactly. Or maybe it's something that they've created, another hybrid type being, and it kind of was able to, maybe it was able to reproduce, because I've heard people talk about little ones and big ones. So I have no idea. You know, I'd love to know more. I'd love to see a, you know, well, I guess I wouldn't, because I'm back. You're back to the same, to the CD5 thing.
To the same quandary.
Yeah, you're back to the same place. So no, you know, I'm not going to go looking for one.
Yeah.
You know, that's not on my radar, but because I've just, everything I've seen from this other realm, unless it's been, you know, I have had really positive angelic encounters.
Beautiful.
And you know, beautiful things happen. But I don't want anything to do with, you know, the part of that realm that puts me in danger or that I'm not 100% certain of. I'm going to stay away from that.
Absolutely.
And I highly recommend everyone else stay away from that too, because we don't have, you're messing with something you don't understand. You're playing with fire, and you got to be very careful.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. That is, that is the warning I give all the time. Like right here next to me is a copy of the Roman ritual. Like that is the rite of exorcism. I don't think I'm going to go out and start practicing the rite of exorcism. Like, no. I don't think I got the chops.
Well, and it's not your path, right? Your path is sharing information, and you're doing a really amazing job at it. Don't stop doing that, you know?
Well, and that's just it, though, is that it can be very hard for experiencers, especially experiencers such as yourself. Where can somebody go for support with something like this? Because,
good question.
I mean, nowadays it's much easier. Mm-hmm. We have the conversation with Michael J.S. Carter regularly that, mm-hmm. like, when he had his first experiences back in the 70s, it would have been almost, like, maybe you'd find a pull tab thing, like...
one random place.
Yeah, like on a back bulletin board at the public library, maybe something like that. Then it became, maybe there was a chat room or something that was out there. If you could find the bulletin board system in the 90s,
right
now, there's, you know, MUFON has their resource experiencer or experiencer resource team, you know, things like that. There's numerous places now that experiencers can go.
Oh yeah. Find a place where you're comfortable is what I would say. Mm. Find a place that fits your spiritual belief system and your, you know, really fits your belief system. You know, pray about it if you're a praying person. I highly recommend that. You know, go to L.A. Marzulli's site, lamarzulli.net. Go to my website, karenwilkinsonauthor.com. Send us a message. You know, if you send me a message, I will do my best to get back to you. I have a place on there where you can get to that. You know, find, you know, I know Vicky, you know, Vicky Joy Anderson, you know, she has a website as well. There are a lot of people out there who are willing to help and work with others and really, be there if we can, you know, there aren't a lot of us, but we're out there.
But precisely, you know, good folks like Sev Talk, stuff like that. People like you who have been through this and make themselves available to help others go through it. It is, it's incredible. It's incredible. And
then we want to be here for people. We want to start the conversation. I want to make it okay for people to say, this has happened to me and I need help, or this has happened to me or I want to stop it, or this has happened to me and I just want to talk about it.
Absolutely.
You know, when I go to conferences, and I'll have a conference schedule on my website for ones that I will be at in next year. We just talk. I just talk to people. You know, anyone who wants to talk, come up and we'll talk. There are places, there are people who will talk. Obviously, I know you've got a website too. So, you know, there are some places. Just find somewhere where you're comfortable that fits your needs, your spiritual needs, and don't give up. You will find a place. I promise.
Absolutely. That is my biggest advice to anybody, whether they're a targeted individual, abductee, whatever it is. Do not give up. Do not give up.
No.
There is a strength inside of you. There's a reason why this is happening. Right. And it's because of your strength that it's happening.
Right. So, you're stronger than you know, and there are more of us out there than you know.
That's right.
I meet every day. I talk to another abductee. Some days I meet 10 of them, you know.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of us out there. A lot of people have had the exact same experience as I have. I'm not alone in this. But I'm trying to... There aren't a lot of women writing about this, and there aren't a lot of people having the conversation, and I'm trying to make it okay to do that. I'm sticking my neck out. I mean, you don't think this doesn't come with ridicule? Yes, it does.
No, that's it.
This is not necessarily well received by all, but that's okay, because this is my path, and this is something I'm going to do, and I'm determined to get this message out and to help people any way I can.
Beautiful, beautiful. That is absolutely amazing, because once again, so many people, think that, you're going to write a book and make all this money. Like, no, it doesn't make you that much money.
It does not.
Appearances don't make you that much money. Like, I'm sorry to break it to you, folks. Most of those people have day jobs.
Yes.
Like, I talk to a lot of them. They still have day jobs. They still have day research that they do for other people.
Right? Yeah. It's like, this does not. Yeah. This
bills. Does not behoove you to come out with.
No.
It's not something that, like, you know, when a potential employer finds out, they're like rip roaring excited about. Typically, you know.
Exactly.
So that's something that I've said on this show for years, is feel free to go look at the history of people that have come out. People like Mike Heston, you know, like the, Fire in the Sky. Okay. Yeah. Fantastic. You know that before that he was wanted for murder, right? Like, they suspected him and his friends of murder and of killing that man. He lost his federal contract.
It's all terrible. It's terrible.
It's a chain of events that normally is not good for the experiencer when they come forward, Karen. No. And it's horrifying to see.
Yeah, you don't do this for accolades or positive attention. Yeah. I mean, I'm doing it because I was led to do it. I really felt the Holy Spirit leading me to do it. And
beautiful.
And it was a very strong push to get this done. And I just want to help people. And I'm tired of hiding in the shadows.
That's it.
And I don't want everyone else to have to hide in the shadows anymore either. I want to make this a conversation that we can have. We can have in public. We can have with anyone we want. And it's okay. This is happening to too many people.
Yeah.
This is probably happening to one in two people. I think there's a statistically right now.
Wow.
And those are, and that was the Roper poll done way back in the 70s, I think. So today, I mean, who knows? Wow. Who knows? We need a good polling on this. Although, you know, I don't know how we would have something we could trust, you know. Are there polls we can trust? I doubt that.
But the important thing is that you are working with people like L.A. Marzulli to help get the word out on these things, to help further this research in other ways. Thank you so much for coming on, sharing your story.
Thank you for having me.
You are welcome anytime. It has been more than a pleasure to sit back and talk about this absolutely harrowing experience in your life. You are such a brave individual to talk about it so candidly. Thank you so much, Karen, for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me here. I'm glad you're so close. I'd love to come back sometime because sitting in
again
person
and
talking,
again.
We will be able to accomplish so much more.
Let's just sit and have coffee sometime.
Well, we will be doing that. We're new friends now. So
absolutely.
Now we're going to be, the four of us, look at my husband and your wife.
That's
We'll be going out.
That's right. We'll conquer the world together.
Absolutely. But thank you so much for having me here and for taking the time to listen.
It's without listening, without open hearts, without open minds, we do not further as humanity, Karen. That is
amen,
how I end
the
show every single time. So
thank you.
With that in mind, everybody, make sure to stop on by L.A. Marzulli's website, lamarzulli.net. That is where you can buy the book. You can also buy the book at KarenWilkinsonAuthor.com.
Right. That will link you back to L.A.'s site for now. Right now, it's exclusively at L.A.'s site. We will expand that out to Amazon and other places.
Absolutely.
But we just did our first release, so limited release. Let's get it out there as quickly as we can.
And just so you know, it is up in our store, but it also links directly to LA's site. Much Thank like you. All of our books for L.A. Marzulli. Exactly. They all link directly to him. I don't want it to go to Amazon. I want him to have the money.
It's much easier if we can do it with each
other. It's fantastic. It's great. So,
we can bypass that middleman.
Absolutely.
Because as you know, right, books are not moneymakers. It's just a way to get the information out there.
Exactly.
So if we can help each other in any way, let's do that.
That's what it's all about. While you were online checking all that out, folks, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can go like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find all of our episodes. That is also where you can find our experiencer page. If you are an experiencer and would like to share your story and your evidence with us, feel free to go to CuriousRealm.com/story. Share your experience with us. We will share it with our experts and try to get you some answers. Thank you so much, as always, for tuning in every week for so many years. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. And remember, stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.